Hello. I want to begin by thanking Emily Burns, of course, and the Terra Foundation of American Art, as well as her colleagues at the INHA for inviting me to participate. I would also like to extend my appreciation for the generosity and effort for all involved. I really appreciate that. My paper today examines a lesser-known period of French appropriation of the Western panorama and its native peoples that occurred in the early decades of the 19th century. Artists such as George Catlin, Carl Bodmer, as well as Alfred Jacob Miller, helped to shape the French image of Western and Native American culture, and frequently their works were described in the tradition of the Enlightenment ideals of the noble savage. However, quite apart from the well-known epic in which George Catlin's Indian Gallery sparked the imagination and the passions of Parisians, I'm proposing that Eugène Delacroix's representation of Indians and Moroccan fighters distill shared cultural codes of the American Indian as a figure of alterity, transformed in a gradual process, transformed for future colonization. Modern literary historians point out that the concept pronounced by Jean-Jacques Rousseau's primitif, simple and pure, had already by the 19th century actually reflected a newly invented typos of a malleable savage. I will argue that the Western subjects by American artist Alfred Jacob Miller are an extension of a European and not necessarily an American appropriation of the other. I approach my subject relying on several constructs, literary, linguistic, and social theories that expand upon the formal and stylistic similarities of the French artist Delacroix and the naively trained American painter. Literary historian Pratima Prasad documents a French construction of a new kind of American Indian character in which the rebellious other shifts from, and I quote here, a cherished vision of a heroic yet defiant Indian to that of a disciplined, malleable, and empathetic savage, unquote. In literary form, the shift is interpreted as a sign of European ambition for expansionism. And in her well-known book, Imperial Eyes, the linguist Mary Louise Pratt defines contact zones as social spaces between the highly asymmetrical powers in which the cultural values clash, grapple, and negotiate with each other. She postulates a linguistic colonization that is just as powerful as any territorial conquest. In the published text, then, narration, disposition, grammar, didactic speech, and the language of emotions are these instruments of cultural coding. The disciplined savage that is so evident in François de Chateaubriand's novels, especially Atla, become the model of America for nearly all French writers in the following decades of the 19th century. Delacroix's painting of the Natchez visually promotes these same precepts of the disciplined savage, language, passage, and tenderize. If I could go back to just for a moment, I'm making this association here in terms of the correspondences between both the style and the chroma, which I'll talk about in detail, as well as in the figural compositions. Back to the Natchez. Because both Delacroix and A.J. Miller had real-life contact experiences in which they were confronted with these new cultural codes, I want to propose that Delacroix's paintings of Arabic figures and A.J. Miller's portrayals of Native Americans demonstrate contact zones that effectively project an already conquered other, reframed by codes of privilege, patriarchy, and sophistication. Transposed into visual terms, the coding of the virile, violent, and exotic-looking actors in Delacroix's Moroccan subjects go beyond the romantic identities of horsemen or warriors. Rather, they convey a visuality of both agent and object. Eurocentric seeing, therefore, determines what is seen. My purpose here is not to pronounce definitively on the question of Delacroix's images as evidence of by now predictable coding of alterity. What I would like to do is to amplify the nature and evidence of this reconstruction of a new kind of American Indian in American art. Nor will I argue for some sort of parity between these artists. Eugène Delacroix is without any doubt the greater artist than Miller in terms of concept, execution, and legacy. What interests me, though, is the unusually strong chromatic and color harmonies and the compositional similarities between them. And I've asked, how did this come about? Nearly every art historian who has studied Miller's work has commented on Delacroix's influence over Miller, stating that, and I quote, he admired Delacroix, or alternatively, that Miller copied Delacroix's 1822 painting, The Bark of Dante, at the Musée Royal. Or, and I quote, Miller's work resembles Delacroix's in style and in exotic subject matter, unquote. I wish to suggest something different, that Miller's admiration went far beyond copying Delacroix's Bark of Dante. It is true to say that Delacroix's rich palette, its chromatic values, saturations, blue-green tonal relationships, are more pronounced than Miller's, but I believe Miller adopted these chromatic harmonies. I'll just show you a couple of them. I'm looking at the green-gold contrast here. Miller adopted these harmonies, nuances, and contrasts, hoping to achieve a similar effect. What I'm proposing is that the compatibility between them lies in the chromatic and tonal balance they offer, which can be explained by the relativity of color effects in the way that Joseph Albers proved that color is relational. We can recognize the similarities, then, in terms of the perceptions of color itself. The actual understanding of the human perception of color develops in the very early 20th century and continues into the present day. However, great masters of color like Titian or Delacroix have practiced these principles without the aid of later scientific data. Our reading of Delacroix's color harmonies attracts both our internal physiological mechanisms of perceptions, as well as our external optical perceptions and its after images that mix in the retina. Light and color, then, on our optic nerve offers internal chromatic effects that inform brain cognition. Physiologically, the colors of the eye, internal to the body, and the material colors of the paint, external to the body, activate our response to the artist's creation. Or to put this in a very different and romantic terminology, we are all in this Delacroix. When I speak of the joy of color for color's sake, this is what I mean. I do not know how it enters your eye like a glass of wine going down your throat, and you are immediately intoxicated. Ever since Robert Beedham's 1961 critical study of Delacroix's exposure to the Osage Indians, performed in Catlin's Indian Gallery, the connection between Delacroix's Moroccan figures and the images of the American Indians was consistently applied. Beedham stated that Delacroix's interest in the American Indians may have been united by, and I quote here, his taste for painting uncivilized people in their own environment, unquote. Beedham argued that Delacroix's interest in American Indians resided in their being models of classical form. From this juncture, all subsequent scholarship repeated this connection between Delacroix and the work of A.J. Miller. Nevertheless, the acknowledgement posed more questions than have been answered, and I will address some of these questions a little later in my paper. The paintings offer instances of social contact zones as a trope for visual conquest and dominance. The culture coding is not singularly attributed to the French identity, but refers to the broader European vision, even among non-colonizing nations. Miller's Western subjects across Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska, Wyoming, and toward the Rocky Mountains were the result of a commission for a wealthy Scottish nobleman. I'm suggesting that it was Miller's patron, William Drummond Stewart, who filtered and constructed the vision of American Native peoples, and thereby Miller's Western scene are really more accurately mirror a Euro system of alterity. Pierre Bourdieu's theories about constructed social boundaries argues for the evident complicity of artists in defending established norms of the superior culture. Bourdieu names, and he calls them high-status cultural signs, such as knowledge, behavior, goods, and credentials, to explain how this sort of imperialist formula constrains and perpetuates a version of a legitimate culture as it stakes out its own social boundaries. I think these points are visible in Delacroix's paintings and in Stuart's attitude toward primitive societies. If we look back to the French impressions of Nouvelle France more than 100 years before Delacroix's rendering of Native Americans, Frenchmen were informed about North America and North American Native peoples through visual material and textual chronicles based on many eyewitness accounts and written by a host of Frenchmen, such as Antoine Simon Lepage Prat, as well as Jean Dumont de Montigny. And these were well before the romantic novels by Chateaubriand. Dumont de Montigny's 1758 account of the Indian Rebellion, the Natchez Indians killed 230 Frenchmen, women, and children at Fort Rosalie, which was located in the area of Natchez, Mississippi. You can see that on the map here, and was part then of the French Louisiana Territory. Reports of this massacre were read and with the greatest alarm and often astonishment in Paris. Eventually, the loss of Nouvelle France in 1763 was certainly a blow economically, and it turned them toward expansion toward Africa. Delacroix first saw actual Native American men and women only in 1845 when George Catlin brought a troop to Paris. And Delacroix made sketches of these exotic peoples. A man of his time, Delacroix read Bernardin de Saint-Pierre, whose novel Paul et Virginie was a popular fictional treatment of French identity and supremacy, which added to the ongoing Euro myth of America. Delacroix's conversations with George Sand and Paul Chenevar, his familiarity with the paintings of George Catlin, as well as Charles Baudelaire's critique, which connected Delacroix's Moroccans and Catlin's Indians, all of these sources contributed to Delacroix's assessment of the American West. But of course, it was his painting, The Natchez, preceded any real sightings of Native Americans, and was inspired by fictional accounts by both Chateaubriand and James Fenimore Cooper. Delacroix described this particular painting in words that I think confirms Chateaubriand's reconstructed persona of the American Indian. The savages, according to Delacroix, have tender feeling, and they're quite different from Dumont de Montigny's early account of brutality and barbarous practices in collecting trophies of human scalps. Delacroix writes, fleeing the massacre of their tribe, two young savages travel up the Mississippi River. During the voyage, the woman is taken by pain of labor. The moment is then when the father holds the newborn in his hand. Both regard him tenderly. Although he began this work as early as 1823, it was not completed and shown until 1835. At another juncture, Miller, who writes the script for his images, as written in his memoirs, he applies, I think, a language that's very similar to Delacroix's descriptive phrases about the Natchez. In this image, titled Indian Encampment, Miller writes with a Eurocentric romantic melancholy, referring to the exotic Persian culture and the native canoes are objects likened to Venetian beauty. The sketch presents an almost Arcadian scene. The simple minds of the savages gives them no brighter heaven hereafter. Their paradise is constructed with at least as much facility as Persian. The scene on the River Osuk in the immediate foreground is an Indian canoe made of birchwood bark. These boats are light and swift, and they're beautifully modeled and reminded one much of the gondolas of Venice. Or alternately, another of Miller's descriptions, posed on the borders of a quiet stream, they may be seen watching their reflection of their dusky charms. Stuart, one of the challenges in studying Alfred Jacob Miller's painting is the question of authorship. I mean by that, Miller's motivation for his travel to the Western territories was at the behest of his Scottish patron, the Lord of Merthyr Castle in Perthshire, Scotland. Stuart, a former captain in the British forces who fought in the Napoleonic Wars alongside of Arthur Wellesley, 1st Duke of Wellington, was a strong personality who directed and dictated the caravan with military orders. Miller, the artist, characterized Stuart, and I quote, as a dignified, strict disciplinarian, somewhat of a marionette, who would not tolerate for a moment any neglect of orders, unquote. While they were traveling across the plains together, Stuart had Miller sketch certain events and selected some of the compositional views. At times, Stuart urged the artist to work more quickly and to add to a number of sketches readied on the spot. Miller was also asked to paint scenes that he did not witness, but occurred during Captain Stuart's earlier trips to the Rocky Mountains. The commission from Stuart resulted in a set of 87 watercolors and sketches made during this Western sojourn with Stuart's entourage. Upon returning to his studio in New Orleans, Miller copied these into oil paintings, which were sent to Scotland in 1839 to decorate Stuart's hunting lodge in the castle. Not long after, Miller also traveled to Scotland and lived at Merthyr Castle for the next 2 years until 1842, working up some of the earlier watercolors and sketches into large oil paintings. For example, this painting here, Crow Attack, Miller painted several versions of it, including a very large oil painting of approximately 5 by 9 feet from Merthyr Castle. And what you're looking at here, of course, is a much smaller version in watercolor. Stuart's predilection for adventurous travel, for meeting danger, as well as his romantic interludes across the Western Plains to the Rocky Mountains, were evident in the scenes by Miller. Stuart commissioned several portraits, including one of Antoine Clément, a mixed-race Métis Indian, as well as some famed French-Canadian trappers. Stuart's romantic relationship with Clément, whom he later brought with him to live in Merthyr Castle as his valet, is well-developed in a recent publication by William Brenman. Following the trek with Miller, the sometimes flamboyant actions of Stuart and his guests across the plains of the U.S. were cause for scandal. In her book, Colonialism, Race, and the French Romantic Imagination, Prasad points to a significant number of examples of French Romantic literature that prefer a newly constructed exotic masculinity with its racial corollary in which the white male represents the interests of the empire, and the colonized male is representative of the rebellious other. There are many narratives that portray the romantic hero concerned with self-identity and alienation. Margaret Waller, in her book, The Male Malady, describes romantic fictions which detail tragic tales of male disempowerment. In a similar manner, Chateaubriand's paradigmatic Mal du siècle hero defines the romantic and privileged heroes as exhausted and debilitated. It seems that Stuart is an exemplary figure for this masculine romantic subjectivity. His series of adventurous exploits across the American West were carried out from a place of privilege, great wealth, and confidence in a posture of unaccountability. His travel adventures succeeded in empowering him, often regaling his entourage with stories of his military exploits. And here's one. The texts that you have before you are written by the artist himself. After the meal, the trappers would settle down for an evening of exchanging accounts of impossible deeds, and Sir William Drummond Stuart would entrance them all with stories of his Napoleonic battles or exotic, undreamed of places. So he's quite a towering figure, physically, economically, and in terms of his iron will. As the second son, Stuart did not inherit the baronet until 1838, when his older brother suddenly died. And in Miller's paintings, again and again, I think we've seen some of them, the figure of Stuart sits astride his white Arabian steed, centered, commanding, powerful. In The Rendezvous, Stewart ventured annually into the American Western Territories for 4 or 5 years prior to hiring Miller to commemorate these adventures in paint. He was one of the first Europeans to witness the annual rendezvous, a gathering that lasted about 3 weeks in the summer among Native American Indians, mountain men, French-Canadian trappers, and fur traders, as well as agents of the major fur trading companies in the East. Stewart was already a well-known figure at the gatherings for his expansive generosity in gifts and hospitality to the Indian tribes. The rendezvous marked an instance of exchange, trading pelts, whiskey, horses, as well as language, custom, and values between the Indians and the Europeans. Historians have pointed out that the relative ease with which Stewart's entourage traveled across the Western frontier meant it was already something of a well-developed travel route. Furthermore, Miller's watercolors and oil paintings consistently illustrate, and I quote here, illustrate Indians in the service of Captain Stewart's adventure, or else they're pointing out the exploitable resources available to the European visitor. The totemic quality of the scene demonstrates the already conquered other, as the Native Americans were already in decline and already transformed into the Euro-American symbol. Yet in ways similar to the empathetic figures of the American Indians, the exotic male figures in Delacroix's painting seem to cross-reference French attachment to North Africa. The actual actions of the Arab chieftains in Delacroix's images are not figures of insurgency, but with coded signs that afford gestures of concession, else they appear constrained by the political realities surrounding them, inspired by the French invasion of Algeria already in 1830. Structurally, the dyad of Indians or Moroccans and privileged white Europeans illustrate an ongoing process of transformative intervention. Ideological and political positions had already begun to be codified as American values, which associated territorial expansion as an unopposed deliverance, a kind of manifest destiny. The ideology relied on heroic narrative that associated native naivete with moral imperatives, a kind of contrived humanitarianism. And this is correspondent with European expansionist ideologies coded as liberalism, an attitude of manifest destiny on its own. And according to historian Peter Masson, this experience of alterity was coded under the wide umbrella of exoticism that converged notions of Oriental savagery, sensuality, and wild animals with the European image of its own popular culture. By way of conclusion, I'm left with a set of questions that I call the problem. Let's hold that for a minute. I call the problem with A.J. Miller and his paintings. The scant accounting of Miller's activities during his first stay in France and Italy makes it difficult to establish which works by Delacroix he saw and copied. Miller was the first American student admitted into the life drawing classes at the École des Beaux-Arts, and he's known to have copied French, Dutch, and Italian masters over the course of his first stay in Europe. That was between 1832 and 34. He traveled to several cities in Italy, settling in Rome, where he copied Raphael's frescoes in the Stanza Signatura. And keep in mind that these are exactly the prints that were particularly favored by Delacroix. The chromatic harmonies show the influence of Delacroix's palette and prompt more questions. Which Delacroix works could he have seen in 1832? Is it possible that he saw several of the watercolors that Delacroix showed in the Salon of 1833 upon returning from Tangier, Morocco? Did Miller copy Orientalist themes that Delacroix oil paintings showed in 1834? Did Miller have the opportunity to see any of the works on his second journey to Europe between 1840 and 42? Was it his patron, Stewart, who suggested that he follow Delacroix's model? For the present, there's no certain way to know if Stewart owned prints by Delacroix or if he suggested Miller travel to see them. Miller's second European trip included a stay in London, and at Stewart's request, Miller studied religious subjects in that city, to meet further commissions of his patron. I might conjecture that the second trip allowed Miller to see more Delacroix works in oils or watercolors or prints, but it cannot be proven just yet because Stewart's collection of paintings and his library were dispersed nearly immediately after his death, and their location remains unknown. That's why we have more of the authenticated watercolors than the oils, which have disappeared. A couple of final points. Miller is known today for nearly exclusively for his subjects of the West, yet nothing by him prior to his visit to France and Italy, and nothing after his return is remotely similar to those scenes of the Western Plains by Native Americans during his trip with Stewart in 1837. Extant works by Miller in collections across the Midwest and the Far West, in Tennessee, Wyoming, Nebraska, Missouri, are reworked paintings of those scenes sketched or painted for Stewart. A second point. It's been pointed out that all of Miller's depictions of horses in herds or singularly are fine Arabian breed, which was scarcely available in the eastern United States and highly unlikely to have been seen on the route followed by Stewart and his entourage. There have been no significant responses to this query. A third point. Miller knew of Delacroix's journey to Morocco, and it appears that another one of Miller's patrons, the sophisticated European traveler, William T. Walters, may have been the one who suggested some Delacroix works to him. Today, 200 of Miller's watercolors exist along with the descriptive text for each scene as part of the Walters Commission in 1858. They appear to be the most reliably authentic body of his work. Miller delivered these 200 watercolors in installments over 21 months, and ultimately they are bound in 3 albums. It's surprising that Miller's herb is, what's surprising about Miller's herb is how they've come to be regarded as canonical views of American art of the West, when they are clearly representative of a more European view of the American West. His art has, I think, gained more prominence in the last few decades because a couple of the scenes, such as Fort Laramie, or the scenes of the rendezvous, are the only extant representations by eyewitnesses. This was the last rendezvous that occurred. Similarly, the Fort Laramie was reconstructed right after this. So they exist almost as historic visions. A telling remark by the French academician Paul Bourget points to this cultural correlation in codes of masculinity, violence, exoticism between Delacroix's Arab horsemen and the rugged battles or native rituals. In 1895, upon seeing Delacroix's painting of the fanatics of Tangier in the home of the American collector, James Hill, Paul Bourget writes, and I quote, "What ground has this canvas covered between the painter's studio and the gallery of a millionaire of the Western frontier?" Another interesting point, I'm going to conclude here, but one of the things I didn't mention is none of Miller's paintings are remotely like his contemporaries, which are much more ethnographic and realist. So I think it supports my idea that Miller's paintings of the West are actually much more of a European-centered, a Euro-centered vision. And I will conclude there. Thank you.